Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello once again, everybody, and welcome to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Hausman, and I'll be your host for today's interview. I'm very excited today to welcome Andrew M. Bush to the podcast. Dr. Bush is an assistant professor of interdisciplinary studies in the Honors College at Coastal Carolina University, and is the author of City in a Garden, Environmental Transformations and Racial Justice in 20th Century Austin, Texas, which came out last year with the University of North Carolina Press, and which we'll be discussing today. Andrew, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks a lot, Steve. I'm really excited to be here to discuss my book.
Before we get into the book, why don't you first tell us a bit about yourself? What path did you take to the world of history, and what is your background as a historian?
So it's kind of interesting. My path actually starts off in India. I was very interested in Eastern religions when I was in college, and I got a fellowship to go to India the summer after I graduated to do some research with a professor. I was there for a few months, and I came back, and I sort of had worse culture shock maybe coming back to the United States, which I had never really left before, than I had actually going to India. And I sort of decided, wow, this is such an interesting place. I kind of saw it as being big and wealthy and in these kind of ways that I hadn't really examined before. And so I kind of changed my focus from the East and from India in particular to the United States. I wound up working in a warehouse for a few years after that, and then I went back to graduate school to get my master's and then PhD in American studies. So my background is in history and also in American studies, which is the way I look at American studies is kind of an interdisciplinary view on history that sort of takes the United States and its relationships with global neighbors as its kind of focus. So that's pretty much my background. I've been teaching now for about 10 years, mostly history classes, but as you can probably tell by my title also, interdisciplinary studies. So I hope that this came across in my book as well, but I use a historical methodology, but I sort of pull from anthropology a little bit, geography a little bit, sociology a little bit, when I sort of conceive my projects.
Yes, that does come across very strongly in your book, in fact. And that's an interesting path that you took. And I got to ask, we might kind of circle back on this question again later, but would you ever be interested in going back to kind of your scholarly roots and doing some work and research on Central and South Asia at all?
Oh, yeah, I would. One of the things that sort of deterred me when I was actually in India was how difficult it was to get things there, to get sort of things accomplished. So I would take, you know, I was in Calcutta and it would take me an hour and a half to get from where I was staying to the central library that was there. And then you'd get there and you'd order these books and you'd fill out call slips for all the books. They wouldn't let you into the stacks. And then, you'd order six books and they'd come back with two and say the other ones are too brittle or you can't look at them. So I was a little bit discouraged, I think, as a 22-year-old fresh out of undergrad with that kind of process. But looking back at that now, I think that would be something that I would really enjoy doing, looking at other aspects of the world. And actually, in kind of a roundabout way, living in Calcutta for a few months got me really interested in urban studies as well, because that is such a vibrant city, but also one with so many social and kind of infrastructural problems, as many cities in the developing world have.
Well, that's a good lead into my next question, which is what got you interested in the topic of the book in question, of the intersection of race and the environment in Austin, Texas specifically?
Sure. So as I said before, I got my PhD in Austin. I actually went there. I actually wrote my master's thesis on sports. I was going to do sports history as my sort of focus. And when I got to Austin, I immediately was kind of interested in the city for a few different reasons. One, I grew up in Chicago and spent most of my life in the Midwest and around Chicago. And Austin is just such a different type of city, so much less urban, I think, in its physical form than Chicago is, and sort of in its social and economic history as well. Right. So when I got to Austin, there were two things that I kind of noticed. One was just how popular the city was in people's imagination. Everybody who was there seemed to love it. And there was just this great vibe about it, much different from many other cities that I had sort of thought about. And as I sort of began investigating it, I began to uncover these really longstanding kind of racial fissures. The city was just starting to kind of gentrify when I got there. And I saw that process taking place firsthand. I did a little bit of digging and noticed that the African American population of Austin had been declining in terms of percentage for a long time, and really consistently as well. It's got one of the lowest percentages of African American residents of any major city in the United States. So my focus initially was kind of on that, this disjunct between the way that so many people love this city and the reasons why they love the city, and this disparity in terms of race. The environmental portion didn't really come in until probably I was pretty close to finishing my dissertation. My dissertation was called Entrepreneurial City, and it was much more about the kind of the political economic growth of the city, focusing on the university and the tech industry, which, you know, some of that is in the book as well. But I sort of realized, like, oh, this story needs, and Austin is such a kind of environmentally friendly city, something that makes it so livable and something that a lot of people really resonates with a lot of people and residents in Austin and did at the time. And so I said, what would happen if I injected environment into this and put an environmental perspective against that kind of race perspective? And it wound up, for me anyways, I think telling the history of the city in as accurate a way as possible, right? Because these two forces, which have really been at work in the city for a long time, that of racial tensions and environmental improvements, that wound up being what I think is the best way to kind of tell the whole story of Austin, because these two aspects are so prominent to the city's history, and I would argue today as well.
Well, let's talk about Austin then as a place. What is the city's environment and natural geography like? And why did people decide to choose Austin as a city site? Why did people decide to live there in the first place? And what's the setting like?
So Austin's really interesting. Most cities have some kind of like natural advantage, right? New York is the perfect harbor, perfect natural harbor. Philadelphia is it a waterway, basically the shortest portage between the Delaware and the Schuylkill River. New Orleans, of course, is at the mouth of the Mississippi. Most cities have a kind of natural reason for being there. As best I can tell, Austin is only there because the founders of Texas, Stephen F. Austin, basically said, this is a beautiful place. He wanted to get away from Houston, which was the capital of Texas at the time, to try to find a new capital. And he said, I found a beautiful place. It was a place that they initially called Waterloo, and the name was changed to Austin a few years after that. And in their descriptions, they characterize it as sort of an Eden. It's beautiful. It's lush. There's a lot of different foliage growing. Of course, there's the river there, so a constant supply of water. And it is really a beautiful place from a natural perspective. The famous landscape architect, Frederick L. Olmsted, actually cut his teeth kind of as a writer. He wrote this book called, it was actually a series of sort of dispatches called The Cotton Kingdom. He took a ride through the American South in the 1850s, a little bit before the Civil War. And it's a wonderful kind of documentation of what the South was like from the perspective of this young New Yorker at the time. And when he gets to Austin, he says, this is where you go from East Texas to West Texas, right? And he was right about that from many different perspectives. So to the east of Austin is kind of what they call Blackland Prairie, sort of rolling hills, typical farmland, kind of similar to much of the Deep South. right? And then right when you get to the west of Austin, you can actually see this, what they call it, the Western Hills. Just to the west of downtown Austin, you start getting the hills. This is something called the Balcones Escarpment, right? This kind of uplift in the territory land. It becomes much more rocky, more hilly. It's colloquially known as the Hill Country, this area to the west of Austin. And there it also gets much drier, right? So Austin is very split between what we might consider like a southern landscape and a western landscape as you get to the west. And that's one reason also why it has such bad or can have such bad weather conditions. You probably want me to get to that a little bit later. So essentially, people moved there because it was this beautiful place. And then the city also had the state government and the university, which were able to attract a lot of sort of a built-in population for the people to run those entities. Obviously, it was the state capital just about from the very beginning of Texas in the 1840s, and then the university was located there in 1883. So those were two reasons, and they use this idea of climate and beauty and environment to kind of sell the city in its early days.
And very early in the book, you point to the year of 1893 as a pivotal year for Austin. Why was that such an important point in the city's history?
Yeah, so I think I actually opened, I actually remember that because that's probably the first, I think that's the first line I wrote in my dissertation, actually, many years ago, which became the book, how 1893 was a pivotal year for Austin. The reason for that is because that's the year that the first Austin Dam was completed. So when Stephen F. Austin and his crew got there, the argument I make is they probably got there in one of these really nice years where there was some rain, but not too much rain. And so they saw Austin as being this beautiful place where in many years, Austin was subject to, very, very extreme weather conditions. So in central Texas, I think Austin gets about 32 inches of rain a year on average, but it rarely gets 32 inches of rain. That's an average between somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 inches of rain and like 10 inches of rain. So it has a lot of extremes. And in general, it's gone through these drought flood cycles, right? So there'll be a drought for 6 or 7 years and then torrential rains the next year and it'll flood and it's all full of water. This is not a very good sort of model for growth because, you know, either you don't have water or you have a very limited amount of water. Or you have too much water and floods. And so the city was flooded out and lost millions of dollars in property and many, many dozens and probably hundreds of people killed in the first 40 years. And alternatively, in the years when it didn't rain, there were water shortages all the time, right? So it's really hard to sell your city to industry and even just to other people who want to move in if you have this kind of lack of stability, right? And so the system, which is called the Colorado River system. The big thing in the 1880s, right, they get the university there, and the sort of city leaders become very interested in this dam and creating it in building a dam because they think that's going to be really good for the long-term economic prospects of the city. And they fund the dam. I think it was 1891, the bond issue passed, and they funded the dam completely publicly. It was a very modern, kind of state-of-the-art dam at the time, what's called a gravity dam. Today looks very basic, just basically like a 12-foot brick wall that went all the way across the dam and basically encased a reservoir that they called Lake McDonald. And when that dam was finished in 1893, they think, and as far as I can tell, it was the largest dam of its kind in the world. It was reported on by Harper's and by Scientific American and a number of other important publications at that time. And it was this sort of civic, it was a symbol of Austin's civic value, the way that the citizens valued the city. And so this was a great thing for them. It actually created power. There was a generator attached to it. It created power. It created jobs. It created leisure opportunities. There was a steamer that the city operated on that little lake behind it, Lake McDowell, that I think was called the Ben Hur. And so it creates all these opportunities. Austin grows a little bit in the 1890s, and then all of a sudden, tragedy strikes basically in the year 1900. As it turns out, it's very difficult to anchor this dam to the limestone bottom of the riverbed, and they did the best job that they could in 1893, but it really wasn't enough. Limestone is very difficult to build something into and to really secure it. So people start noticing that, like, fishing lines are going underneath the dam, and they start realizing, well, the dam is probably kind of separating a little bit from its foundation in the bottom of the river. And in the year 1900, I think it was April of 1900, you know, a bunch of people, it rained a bunch upstream. This must have been a crazy, crazy scene. It was a bright, sunny day, not a cloud in the sky, and the water level's just rising and rising and rising because there had been so much rain upstream, northwest of Austin, where the watershed of the Colorado is. And all of a sudden, boom, there's probably 200 people actually there watching the water come over the dam. They described it as being beautiful, kind of thing. And the dam just breaks. About a 200 foot section right in the middle of the dam just breaks apart from the rest of the dam, gets pushed a few hundred feet downriver. This wall of water comes in, and destroys the powerhouse, the power generating station, which was just, downriver from the dam. I think 17 people were killed and many millions worth of property were lost. So that dam then becomes this kind of symbol of, you know, Austin's failures. It's reported on as a failure widely. This was very much national news at the time. Scientific American, again, writing about that. There was an article, I think, in one of the San Antonio papers. It's called "Death and Ruin at Austin." The day after it happened. So, and it wasn't until a lot later that the federal government actually helped to fund a series of dams that still now stands on the Colorado River northwest of Austin, basically. And I think it's seven dams in total that impound seven reservoirs, and they really allow for Austin to have, one, power, two, recreational opportunities, and three, certainly stability after that. So it wasn't really until the 1930s, though, that was accomplished. So it was a 40-year saga, basically.
And flooding remains an issue in early Austin as well. And as you describe in the book, the floods, to a certain extent, also helped to reveal Austin's racial geography in the early 20th century as well. So can you tell us a bit about Austin's racial geography in these early days, and in particular how white Austinites attempted to keep minority populations out of certain parts of the expanding city?
Certainly. So Austin's, like much of the South, there wasn't this kind of rigid segregation that we might expect in Austin or in many Southern cities at the same time. This, I think, and many people have written about this, is kind of a leftover from the days of slavery, when, of course, blacks and whites live very, very close to one another. So this is also an outcome of the labor market in Austin, because most African Americans worked in kind of the industrial kind of blue collar jobs at slaughterhouses, some of the worst of those types of jobs, or the majority of them, and particularly women, were domestics. Right, so they certainly couldn't afford automobiles. Public transportation wasn't great. So in general, African Americans had to live within a walking distance of white neighborhoods, because that's usually where they were employed, and they had nowhere else to get there. Right, and the city wasn't super populated at the time. It only had around 25,000 people at the turn of the century, so not a really, really big city. What winds up happening is that they wind up living in African Americans in general, and there are some, but not a whole lot of Latin Americans, the vast majority of them Mexican Americans, living there at the time. They wind up living in cheaper areas, and those cheaper areas tend to be in areas that are, for a few different reasons, much more hazardous. Right. So Austin also has two urban creeks, Waller Creek and Shoal Creek, and those, Waller is on kind of the east side of downtown, Shoal is on the west side of downtown. They both their heads are both up north, and they come down and filter into the Colorado River kind of on each side of downtown, right? And those were unimproved, just like the river was in the early part of the 20th century, and they flooded out a great deal, right? So their land was also very cheap there. In some cases, it was free there because of how dangerous it was. And so for African Americans and Latinos, they tended to live in these places that were lower, that were more susceptible to flooding, and also within walking distance of the place where they lived. Now, I think a lot of what kept them out of white areas was economics. They weren't educated. They didn't have the opportunity to become educated very well. And Austin was not a city that had a great deal of low skill or mid skill industrial jobs the way that a Chicago would have at the time, or a Detroit. So there just weren't many opportunities for African Americans from an economic perspective, and Austin from a white perspective was quite a middle class city because so much of its population worked at the university and in government. So these jobs that paid pretty well for the time and that necessitated some education for the most part. So they also had these things called restrictive covenants, right, which were legal in the United States through the 1940s. And we still have restrictive covenants. Many people who purchase a house, they'll sign a restrictive covenant that says basically I have to keep my yard in some kind of order. I can't paint my house bright pink. These restrictions basically on your property that are still quite commonplace today. Before the 1940s, it was commonplace and almost ubiquitous in many cities and suburban locations to include a racial covenant in there to say that you cannot sell your house to African Americans or to other groups that were seen by those whites as not being welcome in those places. I'll give a little plug here. My old colleague, Elliot Treader, has written a wonderful book on that very topic called Austin Restricted, where he kind of maps out what racial covenants were like in the 1930s and 1940s in Austin. He does a wonderful job with that. And so that's essentially what Austin's geography was. It was not sort of segregated in the way that we think today, where there was a large, you know, where there'd be a large African-American neighborhood in one part of the city and a large white neighborhood in the other part of the city. It was rather pockets. But those pockets were defined principally by relationship to, or proximity to, I should say, environmental hazards. And there were also some man-made hazards. So I wasn't able to tell which came first, but there were at least two African-American neighborhoods and one Latino neighborhood that had a garbage dump in them, place where garbage was dumped. It could be that the land was so cheap that it attracted poorer people, but it also could be that was just a convenient place for the dumping to take place, and really nobody cared enough about the African-American community to not dump trash in their neighborhood. So what you wind up getting from this is really strong health disparities in those first racial health disparities in those first couple decades of the 20th century, where African-Americans had much higher rates of almost any kind of disease, from tuberculosis to typhoid to just about everything. And in some cases, 5-7 times as high rates of some of these very bad diseases.
One of my big takeaways from the book is that, like a lot of cities in the kind of broader southwestern region of the United States, Austin is a city that is defined in a lot of ways by water. But what makes it kind of different compared to a city as, like, say, Phoenix, for instance, a city like Phoenix will have too little water, whereas Austin never really has that problem. And water, in a lot of ways, as you describe in the book, becomes central to the city's history and to the city's identity. Could you talk about that a little bit, and specifically about the importance, particularly in the post-war period, of the Austin Aqua Festival?
Yeah, sure. So my argument is that sort of in that first period that we just got done discussing, that nature and water in particular is sort of something that Austinites fight against, that they try to overcome, that they use technology to try to kind of harness. And this is kind of what the dam means and what urban planning means for Austin. They wind up harnessing the river, sort of putting it to work for the people, as Lyndon Johnson always liked to say. And then in the era after they were able to do that, they start selling the city in terms of water, because, of course, as you said, the Southwest is a pretty arid place. So Austin, all of a sudden, Austin city leaders were always much sort of more willing than most other municipal governments in Texas to use the federal government and take advantage of those federal resources. Tom Miller, who was the mayor in the 30s and again in the 50s, was a big New Dealer. Of course, Lyndon Johnson cut his teeth as a New Dealer and kind of hitched his wagon to FDR very early on in his political career. And so they were able to take advantage of that, and they have these dams, and all of a sudden, right after World War II, they have all of this water, as you were saying. They have a surplus of water and a surplus of energy. They actually begin selling those resources to other communities around Texas who don't have those kind of things. So Austin, of course, is looking to grow now, right? The whole idea of having these dams and to control water and have these new resources was to be able to grow. And the way that they think about growing is really unique. I think it's this kind of three-pronged thing where they see what's happening in some cities in the 1950s and they say, we don't really want industry here or traditional industry. Traditional industry attracts people who don't have people who don't have skills, people we just don't necessarily want to attract here. So how do we do that? Right? We create this identity for our city that's based around white collar labor, and we also have the advantage of having water and having a nice natural environment, right? So it's perfect for this kind of suburban landscape that develops there. And the idea is that you can have white collar workers who are working in these new tech industries or maybe with the government or at the university, and they can take advantage of the area's beautiful natural opportunities and then plenty of water, right? And so water becomes very central to their kind of to the city's cultural identity. And this is demonstrated best in something called Austin Aqua Festival, which is initiated in 1961. And Aquafest, as it's colloquially called, the forerunner to what's today South by Southwest in Austin, the film and music kind of festival. It was this week-long, or maybe two-week-long, something like that. It changed every year, festival. It usually took place in the middle of the summer when business was down. And it was, one, a celebration of water, right? The city's water resources were sort of put up on a showcase for people from around the region to see. They'd have parades, but they'd also have a parade down the Colorado River. It was called Town Lake, the impounded part of the Colorado River adjacent to downtown Austin. There would be all sorts of other water activities. There was usually like this big canoe race that was teams of canoers coming all the way down the 60-mile stretch of the Colorado River, and then finishing up in Austin. There were sorts of fishing tournaments and things like this. There were beauty pageants and some of these great sort of period pieces where, you know, the winner of the beauty pageant is in this classic old Chevrolet convertible, and they put the convertible out there and kind of in the middle of the lake. I'm not sure how they did that, technologically, but it's kind of just to showcase Austin's water. And they mix it into with other aspects of Austin's culture. So they try to showcase kind of Austin's very diverse heritage by having different nights that, you know, they had like Polish night and Czechoslovakian night and Chicano night that they had to showcase Austin's kind of history of ethnic diversity. They'd have a lot of music. That's kind of how it evolved a little bit into South by Southwest. They had one of the big years, they had Adam Westcomb, who played Batman, and he was kind of like the leader of the big parade on the penultimate day of the Aquafest. So Aquafest is this kind of way that the city showcases itself and its resources and creates a new kind of center of its own cultural heritage.
And Aquafest is also, as you describe in the book, not free from the city's pretty stark racial geography either. So how did this festival both reveal and reinforce social and racial hierarchies in Austin?
Yeah, so this didn't really happen until the 1970s, or I guess it happened, but it didn't become discussed until the 1970s when you start seeing this more Chicano movement emerge on Austin's east side. So as I talked about before, I guess this would be a good place to talk about the new kind of racial geography of Austin. But Austin was very pocketed in terms of its different populations. That changes after 1928. In 1928, the city comes up with its first urban plan. And this is in the wake of some of the upheavals of the late 19-teens. So after World War One, many African Americans during World War One moved to cities from rural areas because, of course, productions increased during wars, and because a lot of the white people were off fighting in World War One. And so when the war is over, one, there's this really bad economic downturn right after World War One, and two, all of these white people are returning now to cities that are packed with people, and they're rubbing up against African Americans in ways that they hadn't before. And in 1919, a number of race riots break out all over the country. The biggest one, probably the worst one, was in Chicago, and there were a few of them in Texas. And what this did was it really put mixed in with the New Negro movements of the 1920s, which was sort of an assertion among African Americans for more autonomy and for more independence and rights. It was centered in New York, but also was, you know, kind of spilled out to other places. This kind of scared a lot of city leaders, and they said, we need to rethink kind of the way that we operate from a geographic perspective in our race relations broadly. So what they did was, it was illegal to zone areas racially. So you can't, you couldn't say that African Americans have to live in this area, like, legally, and whites can live in this area legally. So the way that the Austin City Plan gets around that is they basically say, what we can do is we can deliver separate but equal services, right? So this is the era of Jim Crow. Separate but equal services. And so what they do is they move the African-American school onto what was colloquially called the East Side, today east of Interstate 35, between about 5th and 12th Streets, kind of right in there. They move the African-American park over there. They build an African-American park over there. They move the African-American schools, the African-American libraries, all the kind of public institutions in separate but equal for African-Americans. They move them over there. And so by the 1940s, and certainly by the 1950s, you have this brand new kind of racial geography, right, that's there. And there's this stark difference. Most Latinos and almost all African-Americans live east of what becomes I-35 in 1962, or before that was East Avenue. And most white Austinites live west of East Austin. Now, south of the river, it was a little different, a little bit more integrated, but that was still kind of far away at the time in the 1950s from central Austin. Right? So you have these stark racial geographies. And what winds up happening with Aquafest is that a lot of the kind of dirty parts of Aquafest and the what we might call the annoyances of Aquafest were situated in the part of the river that was adjacent to the Mexican-American neighborhood east of what's the I-35, or in 1972-73 was I-35. And what happens is they basically put the big thing that set everybody off was these speedboat races. So, again, another way to kind of enjoy water is these speedboat races. But they put the speedboat races adjacent to the Mexican American neighborhoods. And of course, speedboat races are loud, they're dirty, the smell of gas. And a lot of the residents kind of complained of, you know, spectators coming in, urinating in their yards, just treating the neighborhood disrespectfully. And the group of Latinos that kind of stood up for this basically said, listen, we want these boat races to take place somewhere else. This is a clear example of how you guys don't care about how the city doesn't care about our neighborhoods or about the people that live here, because you put probably the worst aspect of the festival, or the one that's the least conducive to having a livable neighborhood, you put that right in our neighborhood, and then the things that aren't conducive, or the things that aren't quite as upsetting, are in other parts of the city. So I think that Aquafest, in a sense, certainly demonstrates these kind of racial differences geographically, and it also becomes a sort of place where the Latino heritage and pride movements were, they sort of cut their teeth on that.
Earlier, you mentioned the importance of the University of Texas and of the state government's location in Austin. And even though we're kind of jumping around a bit chronologically here, I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the importance of these institutions in how the city positioned itself, particularly after World War II, as it's described in the book, as a city with industry without smokestacks, and then how all of this kind of goes on to reify the sorts of environmental racism that you've been talking about throughout the city's history as well.
Yeah, so industry without smokestacks is one of my favorite phrases from the book. Yeah, and this is, I took this directly from the Chamber of Commerce in the 1950s. This is exactly what they say that they want. And what they mean by that is, I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but as they come out of World War II, they say, listen, we got to figure this out. Our agricultural economy is waning, as it was for many cities in the American South and in the American West as well at the time. What are we going to do to kind of compete after World War II? And they hire this planner who comes in from New York, an urban guy's an urban planner named Richardson Wood, and they ask him, what should we do? And he hangs out in Austin for a little while and basically comes back with this report. And this report kind of guides the way that the city thinks, I think, about their economic growth throughout the next few decades after that. And basically what he says, it's pretty simple. He says two things. He said, Austin has an advantage in that it doesn't have industry. And because it's not kind of saddled with this industry, and it's a nice place to live because of that. And two, Austin's got the university, right? So these things together mean that what Austin should do is to follow a path that does not rely on industry, and to focus on knowledge labor, right? To focus on creative workers, white collar workers, and particularly people who work in science and technology, because the university was pretty strong in that for the time. It wasn't sort of on the same level as a Stanford or an MIT by any means. But I would say by World War II, UT was established as probably the preeminent scientific and technological university in the Southwest. I'm not, I can't 100% stand by that, but it was certainly among the best there. During World War II, they had attracted a good deal of money from the federal government for research into war-related activities. They also had this fortuitous, the university also had a very fortuitous kind of encounter where they were able to get the federal government to basically give them this old magnesium plant that had been built during World War II with federal funding to harvest magnesium and turn it, I'm not exactly sure what they used it for, but something related to the war. And after that, this was a pretty common practice among the federal government to give away war-related materials, war-related places. So there's this big kind of, factory-type thing about 9 miles north-northwest of the campus, and all of a sudden the university gets it, right? They get it for free. And there's a professor, a few professors, the most prominent was named J. Neal Thompson, and they basically say, okay, this is a place where we can bring off-campus, and the campus is small, it's locked in the neighborhood, space was always a big concern on UT campus, I'd say it still is today even, and this gives them an off-campus facility where they can really concentrate on bringing in federal funding. In the 1950s, with the Cold War, the federal government starts funding particularly military, but all types of science and technology related research, much more so than they had in the past. And so universities try to take advantage of this, and UT is one of them. And this off-campus facility, which becomes known as the Balcones Research Center, and today it's called the Pickle Research Center after J.J. Pickle, the congressman from the area for many years, becomes the kind of central place for this. By the mid-1950s, there's something like 19 science-oriented laboratories working out of there. It's heavily funded, millions of dollars of federal money coming in every year. And so that's a pretty important part of that equation, right? And from that is sort of where the nascent seeds of Austin's tech industry are born out of that. So the first of Austin's large homegrown companies, Tracor, was established in the mid-1950s. That was a spinoff company from the Balcones facility. A few people who worked at the Balcones facility, researchers, decided, hey, we want to go into private business. We have this idea that we think could work really well. And so they break off from there and form their own company. That's what a spinoff is. And many of Austin's early, certainly in the 1950s and 1960s, many of the early tech companies there were generated by the Balcones facility and by UT more broadly, right? From the city's perspective, of course, they want this white-collar workforce because they think it's good for them. And they also think that this nice environment is something that's really key to bringing in industry without smokestacks because, higher-skilled workers, particularly in the sciences, are mobile, right? They are able to to work in their choice of places many ways because they're in such high demand. So the key, and this is something that become a thought that becomes commonplace in the 1980s or 1990s, that Austin really had it a little bit earlier, I think, than most cities. The key is creating a nice quality of life for them. And so this is also where the problems come in terms of race, right? They assume in the 1950s that having a nice environment means being away from all things that are urban, right? So this is when you start getting heavy levels of real suburban, single-use zoning landscapes in Western Austin and in Northern Austin, especially with these brand new kind of suburban homes that are in close proximity to sites of water recreation, close proximity to parks, to other outdoor activities. And to do this, or in the way that they think they need to do it, that means to kind of segregate urban uses. So all of the industry in Austin is basically pushed into East Austin, where the minorities are. And certainly the minorities in Austin are seen as part of that kind of urban blight that city leaders want to keep out of view. So essentially they use in the 1950s eminent domain legislation, which basically means that the government can take land away from people if they deem it unfit for use. And they use that and they use urban renewal, which is a much more complicated topic that I probably shouldn't get into too deeply. But anyway, a long story short is that they basically remove many of the remaining African Americans from west of Interstate 35 and move them east of I-35. So it's just kind of like I guess federally sanctioned racial cleansing of some of these places. Really, one of the sadder aspects of Austin's history, I would say. In this effort to create this kind of environment that they thought white collar workers would enjoy. So this is where you get that idea of kind of city in a garden, that there's this wholly created area that's very urban, higher levels of density, way higher levels of poverty, most of the areas in heavy industry and other kind of dirty activities, along with most of the area's racial minorities. And then that's separated from a very suburban, you know, what I would metaphorically call a garden of white Austin west of the interstate.
As you said a little bit earlier, it's in the context of the Austin Aqua Festival. It's in the 1970s and 1980s, however, when you have people that are beginning to push against a lot of these city plans for growth and certain aspects of this very self-consciously constructed identity of Austin. So how and why does this happen? And why does Barton Springs become a particular flashpoint here?
Great. So as in many places, really the environmental movements, what we would call modern environmental movements, emerge in the 1960s usually. And those are directly related to a number of different things. One would be the book Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, a Pittsburgher, who wrote this book called Silent Spring that sort of exposed the issues with the chemical industry. And it was a major bestseller. I believe it was published in 1963. It was the early 60s. I'm certain about that. At the same time, you get these people are becoming cognizant of some of the environmental problems that are happening in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. In particular, part of that Silent Spring, part of it is things like, you know, spraying DDT in suburban neighborhoods. Part of it is the strong increase in the use of chemicals in many aspects of life. Part of it is increased suburban growth. So suburbanization in the 1950s used up a great deal of land, taking up landscapes on urban peripheries, all kinds of things. Right, so by that late 1960s and 1970s, many cities, again, suburbs, begin having environmental movements, and in Austin, this is no different. So you start getting these people that say, they're saying, wait a second, right? The reason why Austin has been so successful and why it's such a nice place to live is because of its quality of life, right? We have these water resources. We don't have a lot of overgrowth. We have a public, sort of public spirit that's always cared about our civic consciousness, I might say, that's always kind of cared about our environment. And as the city begins to grow and as our leaders worry too much about growth, and think about growth more than quality of life, those things are going to go away. Roberta Crenshaw was the central figure in this. She probably deserves much more credit for modern Austin and for it, for many of the nice things in modern Austin than she deserved. She at first just basically kind of stood up in a grassroots way to the to city leaders who wanted growth, particularly around her. Her big thing was around the Colorado River downtown. Many of the growth advocates or the growth machine wanted to, you know, have the city sell parks to turn them into private places along the water. She basically stopped them from doing that, right? So she kind of starts this, and it's not really until the mid-late 1970s that Barton Springs becomes central to this. In the late 60s also, the students are really important to the environmental movement. There was a guy, a regent of the University of Texas, a very powerful man named Frank Irwin. The main arena on the University of Texas campus is named after him. He's one of the more powerful regents. And he wanted to actually move the football stadium a little bit. And he called in some people to basically clear out a couple groves of trees around Waller Creek, which runs through Austin's campus. And this created a great deal of consternation among students, and it becomes this kind of catalyzing moment where a number of students, as well as a number of these kind of early pioneers of environmentalism in Austin, get together and sort of find some common ground. Barton Springs, again, doesn't become really central to this narrative until the late 70s. And the reason for that is because, as I had mentioned before, Austin, in the sort of western part of Austin, is what's considered the most beautiful part. The rolling hills, the hill country, and the real estate there after the rivers were, or after the river was dammed and becomes much more stable, these areas become much, much more expensive. And so realtors or real estate developers begin building out there. And Austin's got Austin has this interesting, again, sort of underground world where most of the water that it gets now is from the Edwards Aquifer, this very large underground lake, basically, that kind of sits underneath Southwest Austin. And Barton Springs, which is a natural springs that's been sort of central to many groups of people that have lived in the area for hundreds of years, is fed by that aquifer, right? And Barton Springs is a place in Austin's always sort of been central to Austin's identity. It has this long history of being a place for kind of civic ceremonies, recreation, of course, a place to cool off in the summer. If you ever lived in Austin for a long time in the summer, getting into a pool in the afternoon or evening, is a really important part of life for a lot of people who live there. And so what happens is that in the western portion of the city, when they start doing these big housing developments, as the city begins to grow, and of course, real estate developers and also people moving into Austin, they want to live in these natural spaces. It's very similar to what I was talking about earlier in the 1950s, with suburban locations and very close proximity to nature. So what happens is the construction from these places, the materials that that get on roads and then are washed off by rain, these types of things begin to filter into the aquifer, right? And then they begin to filter into Barton Springs. So all of a sudden, in the late 1970s and early 1980s, Barton Springs starts to get really murky all the time, and people don't quite know what's going on. And then it's shut down, right, periodically in the 1970s and 1980s. All of a sudden, Barton Springs becomes this place where people who have lived there for a while begin to say, hey, what's going on here, right? Growth is not just something that's annoying at this point. It's not just, you know, it's not just jamming up traffic and doing these other kinds of things, but it's really wrecking the city, the places in the city or the parts of the city that we care about the most. Right. So throughout the 1980s, there's a number of different people, and Save Our Springs Alliance is the central group, but a number of different kind of neighborhood groups come together over these issues. The environmental movement in Austin had been quite fragmented in the 1970s. There's these small neighborhood groups that are concentrating mostly on their neighborhoods. There's this public planning initiative called Austin Tomorrow in the 1970s, which kind of reifies the neighborhood as the most important sort of spatial unit in thinking about how to properly plan the city. And that sort of carries through into the late 1970s. It's Barton Springs that really creates a kind of centralized focus or a collective focus for the environmental movement. And that grows throughout the 1980s. Austin explodes in the 1980s. This is when Microelectronics and Computer Corporation, which was a federal consortium of tech-related semiconductor companies, chose to locate in Austin, and just a ton of other defense and technology businesses located in Austin in the 1980s, and the city just grows exponentially during that decade. And so the threat becomes worse as the city grows, and more people begin sort of seeing Barton Springs as, I think you used the word flashpoint. It was this perfect kind of symbol of the people who want Austin to maintain kind of quality of life and the spirit of the city versus the real estate developers and business-oriented interests who just want to kind of make money from Austin. So they begin seeing it as this kind of life and death struggle there between those who care about Austin and those who don't.
And obviously, Austin is still extant, a living city. And so the story that you tell has not ended yet. And you bring the story in your book right up until and into the 21st century. So can you tell us a little bit about Austin today and how some of the issues that you describe in the book, how some of them have been resolved and how some are ongoing and how the city is facing new problems in terms of race and environment today as well?
Sure. So in those 1990s, early 1990s, as the kind of mainstream environmental movement is cresting, and with Barton Springs at its center, the sort of minority environmental movement is beginning to take shape as well. And this is led by a group called PODEER, People in Defense of Earth and Her Resources. And it's mostly a group of Latinos, but it's a number of different interests, mostly from the East Side. And they look at the environment a little bit differently, where the sort of central motif of the mainstream environmentalists in Barton Springs is that we want to protect Barton Springs because it sort of shows what we are, because it's a recreational site that we want to use, and we're fighting against developers. Environmentalists on the East Side basically more saw themselves as part of the environment. They saw their neighborhoods as part of the environment. They saw their communities as part of the environment. They certainly enjoyed their parks and their open spaces, but they thought that their actual lived communities, like their day-to-day lives, were part of the environment as well. And so they kind of theorize the environment in this way, and they look at the environment a little bit differently. The sort of issue that codified them was these gas tank farms. So I didn't know this until I read the book, but there are these places basically where gas companies store gas in these huge tanks. They almost look like water towers, kind of. And in the early 1990s, where they had been located in East Austin, sometimes in very close proximity to neighborhoods and to people's homes for a long time, since the 1950s. And they basically, the early East Side environmentalists uncover this. And they basically say to the city elites, like, look, this isn't okay. They get it. They publicize this. They went door to door and basically did a study of people who were getting sick in the neighborhoods who live by them, all kinds of other problems, and they get the city to remove them. So this huge victory. They spent a lot of time concentrating on the hazards of the high tech industry, which were also tended to be located. The manufacturing facilities tended to be located in East Austin, where the kind of more research-oriented or think-type places were located more in West Austin. They concentrated a great deal on the problems associated with those things. So in the 1990s, you have and sometimes these two environmental movements sort of came together, but sometimes they really didn't. They had sort of separate emphases in a way. And so, but in the 1990s, they both won a lot of victories. So SOS wins in 1991, basically creating legislation where they are going to curtail a good deal of the development and highly kind of restrict a good deal of that development in West Austin. Poder and the Eastsiders, as I say, win a few battles, get these gas tanks removed, and kind of put some checks on the pollution generated by the tech industry. And then the place where they kind of fall apart, though, and this is the interesting thing, I think, for the modern era or for the 21st century, is that in 1997, the Green Council, what's colloquially known as the Green Council, wins in Austin with Kirk Watson as the mayor. And so all the council members on Austin City Council have some kind of relationship to the environmental movement. And what they do is they set out to figure out a plan where environmentalists and developers can both kind of be happy together. And that plan is, they basically say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to cut off development in these sensitive areas over the aquifer on the west side of Austin. But what we're going to do is we're going to incentivize new development taking place in the downtown. Like many cities in the post-war era, and focusing on suburbanization and most of the resources are going into building these new suburban developments, the central city kind of lags behind. Excuse me. And in Austin, this was the case as well. So basically, the city says, look, Kirk Watson especially says, look, what we're going to do is we're going to pour a bunch of money into the downtown area, and we are going to give you guys a bunch of tax breaks and other subsidies if you move your investment into the city. They create a map of Austin, which is called the Desired Developmental Zone, and that's all in downtown Austin. And what they do is they basically say they buy up a bunch of land in western Austin on the periphery and say, we're not going to develop on this. This is going to be undeveloped, right? So this is something that works, and a lot of people in Austin, I think, were interested in this new kind of urban living sort of paradigm, right? So this kind of works, and it's celebrated as this big victory after, 20 years, the environmentalists and developers finally figure it out, where each one sort of gets what they want. The problem with that is that the development that took place downtown certainly spilled over into the east side, right? So what happens is that all of a sudden now you have these incentives, and you also have a lot of very nicely priced, very cheap land in East Austin. And the city looks at the developer and say, okay, I can make a great deal of profit if I can redevelop this and maybe market it to middle class, if I can buy it cheap, redevelop it, and market it to middle class people. And the city has the same kind of idea that Austin is a city that's always on the lookout for local property tax, basically, because so much of their relatively expensive and valuable land can't be taxed. Like the whole University of Texas campus, all of the government buildings just south of there, and the state capitol, that's really prime real estate for Austin from a tax perspective, but it can never be taxed because those entities are part of the state. So they don't get to receive any property tax from those places. So the city was really on the lookout for increasing the value of places where it could generate property tax from. So very, very quickly, and really within a few years after that, we start seeing signs of gentrification, new urbanist developments going up, higher priced condominiums going up, all sorts of other like boutique shops that are meant to draw in mostly white middle class clientele going up. And what you start seeing is demographically, by 2000, certainly, and by 2010, it just becomes intense, is that those areas have undergone rapid, rapid change, a demographic change characteristic of gentrification. So they've become much less African-American and Latino and much more white and significantly younger and wealthier than they were before. Even though I'm done with this project, I'm very, very interested in seeing what the 2020 census is going to say. My guess is it's going to say that some of the neighborhoods in East Austin are some of the most heavily gentrified over the last decade of any neighborhoods, of any zip codes, I would guess, in the entire country. I've been back recently a few times. I went and did some research for my next book project just this past summer, and it's just incredible. It doesn't even look like the same city since the last time I was there, which was about 3 years previous to that. So, and from a demographic perspective, we'll see this as well. Austin now has this very kind of inverted geography where the majority, there's a higher percentage of African Americans living in suburbs of Austin than there are living in the city. And you're also starting to see a great deal of Mexican Americans and other Latinos being kind of pushed out of those central neighborhoods into more peripheral locations. So it's this kind of really, I think, sad ending to the book, but the book kind of explains it as well. And that's that as neighborhoods become more valuable, as people begin to see these neighborhoods as more valuable, they also begin to price out minorities who have lived there, and in many cases were forced to live there for, you know, generations previous to that. So it's certainly something that that urban planning has to be ready to address in the future.
My last question is, it's always kind of a toughie to ask of my guests, but I'm always curious if there's one takeaway of this, you know, large and complicated book and the story that you tell, but if there's one takeaway that you hope readers come away from this book with, what would it be?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think that what I'd want them to take away from the book is that when we look at Austin or when we look at cities and we say they're sustainable, right, that always has... That has many different meanings, and that term is not stable, that many different people feel differently about what that means. And while Austin is very much lauded for its environment, for its being able to maintain a kind of environmental feeling, an environmental culture, I would say there too, and also a very nice environmental and sustainable infrastructure, that it has not been very sustainable for its minority residents. And so when we look at sustainability, like I consider this book hopefully to be something of a history of sustainability in a case study, a history of urban sustainability in a case study. And I think that when we look at sustainability, we have to kind of question whether or not it's truly sustainable across racial and class divides.
Your critique of sustainability reminded me a little bit of Andrew Hurley's great book about Gary, Indiana, Environmental Inequalities, and how he talks kind of in a similar way about this urban setting and about how environmentalism fractures along these kind of racialized lines as well. I really appreciated that critique. I thought it was very well done.
That's very flattering, because that's a great book. Just to be mentioned in the same sentence is really an honor.
You mentioned you were back in Austin recently doing research for your next project. Could we get a bit of a preview of what that is, what the next thing coming down the pike for you might be?
Sure. My next project is kind of taking up, I think I mentioned to you that that my dissertation was kind of a political economic emphasis in Austin. What I'm doing now in the book, it's tentatively titled, I'm kind of just beginning to get back into it, and my guess is it probably won't be published for a few years. The tentative title is The Myth of the Market, Texas and the Paradox of Neoliberalism. And essentially what this book is it's a book about Texas's kind of aspects of Texas economic history from World War II till roughly the 1990s, the year 2000. And my basic argument is that Texas is often held up as this kind of paradigm of small government, free enterprise success. And what I found over the years in studying Austin and in studying other places in Texas, I worked in Dallas for a year before this, so I was there as well, and I'm going to incorporate that into the book. What I found was that really that's a myth. It actually, Texas economy has been driven very much by private-public partnerships and by a really strong sense of government within the economy. So I'm going to try to break that kind of free market myth mythos about what's made Texas such an economic powerhouse. So that's the kind of essence of what I'm working on now.
All right. Well, I will keep my eye out for it somewhere down the line.
Cool. Andrew
M. Bush is an assistant professor of interdisciplinary studies in the Honors College at Coastal Carolina University. His book, City in a Garden, came out just last year with the University of North Carolina Press. Andrew, thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Steve. It was great chatting with you.